Welcome to Season 2 of Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations. We hope you enjoyed Season 1 as much as we did putting it together. A local rock and roll expert is with me again, fellow Clevelander Frank Ost. Frank, welcome back to Season 2.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get started. Hall of Fame inductees 2006, as we're running them down. Pretty good class, I would say. Black Sabbath started things off. Formed in 1968 in Birmingham. We already talked about Birmingham, England. Frankie being the home of Spencer Davis Group and Dexy's Midnight Runners. Remember Come On Eileen? Duran Duran, Fine Young Cannibals, Jeff Lynne, John Lodge of the Moody Blues, even Joan Armatrading. And some of these groups, even Dexy's Midnight Runners, they had a little run in the early 80s,
right.
But Black Sabbath came from there. What do you think of that group?
I like them overall. It was never one of my favorite groups, but you have to respect what they brought to the table, and they basically took and ran with, I don't know if they invented it, but they took and ran with the heavy metal scene.
They did. Ozzy left in the late 70s. They continued to perform with other members all the way until 2017.
That's right.
Been around a long time. Lynyrd Skynyrd, Jacksonville, Florida. Not an overnight success by any means. They worked the clubs and small venues for at least 5 years. Released their first album in 1973. The Southern rock band, best known for Freebird and Sweet Home Alabama. Many of the artists there were taken too soon, including Ronnie Van Zant and Steve Gaines, who replaced Ed King a couple of years earlier. Ed was in Strawberry Alarm Clock, as you know,
right,
from previous episodes. And Steve's older sister, Cassie, a backup singer with the band, was also taken from us in that plane crash. A lot of other band members on that plane were injured, and some very severely, weren't they?
Yes, absolutely.
So that band, really, you know, they've gotten together again in other forms, haven't they, over the years?
Right, absolutely. They've been called a glorified garage band, and I say that in all the best ways possible, because their sound is new, it's different, and for Southern rock, it really, really rocks.
That album, Street Survivor, was released just days before that tragic plane crash in October 1977.
Right.
I think they would have gone on and on. That was a hard-working band. They were putting out albums, like a lot of artists were, every year, pretty
mm-hmm.
much. And the live stuff, they were great in concert, and they were, of course, on tour when this happened.
That's
tragic.
Right.
Miles Davis. Miles Dewey Davis III, the jazz trumpeter, band leader, composer. What a talent. I'm sure you liked Miles Davis as much as I did.
Yeah, he obviously broke so many barriers in jazz music, and they couldn't ignore him in rock music either. You know, his phrasing and a lot of the things he did.
In 1944, he took his father's advice and began studying at the Institute of Music Arts, later known as the Juilliard School in New York City. He got bored with that, would rarely attend class, so started playing in the clubs of Harlem in 45, and would replace Dizzy Gillespie in Charlie Parker's quintet. And he was on his way. You may remember him from Time After Time and Human Nature, some of the songs he put together in the mid-80s. But Miles Davis, a great trumpet player, passed away at age 65 only in 1991.
Yeah, in fact, there's always been an argument about what the greatest rock and roll album is, but there seems to be no argument that Kind of Blue by Miles Davis is the greatest jazz album of all time.
He was a good one. Blondie. The New York City group, founded 1974 by Debbie Harry and Chris Stein, they played the clubs too, as all these bands did, really, in Manhattan, and found more success in the UK and Australia before coming over here with that breakout album Parallel Lines in 1978, produced by Mike Chapman, who did not like their instrumentation. He didn't think they were very talented as musicians.
Really?
So, yeah. So, but he wound up producing all their stuff. It was funny, they didn't get along real well. She called him a dictator, Debbie Harry did, and yet he produced three more of their albums and also produced The Knack.
Oh, okay.
You know, get The Knack. The songwriting partner of Mike's was Nicky Chinn, who also wrote songs you know, like Ballroom Blitz and Susie Quattro's hits 48 Crash and Stumbling In. So
wow.
Mike Chapman certainly had some talent. Heart of Glass, January 79, that blend of disco and new wave. It was perfect timing for that band, wasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely came out of nowhere and became a huge hit.
One way or another, Rapture, The Tide is High. And Frankie Blondie recently sold off their songwriting catalog to a company named Hypnosis, who've been busy spending close to $1 billion the last couple years, gobbling up songwriting catalogs from the likes of The Pretenders and Lindsey Buckingham, who recently sold to them. Stevie Nicks sold to a company called Primary Wave 80% of her catalog, which includes the Fleetwood Mac stuff, for $100 million, and Bob Dylan got a reported $300 to $400 million for his 600-plus song catalog, which he sold recently to Universal Music Publishing Group. Lastly, Sex Pistols, the controversial punk rock group from London featuring Johnny Rotten. Sid Vicious would join in 77. They had more success, obviously, in the UK than here. I was never into the Sex Pistols, kind of like Black Sabbath, just not my thing.
Absolutely. And really, there's only one album that they hang their hat on, and so it's hard for me to understand why they've been such a revered group, but I guess it was just the time.
And the timing, you know, it came around at the very start of the new wave. Segment in the late 70s into the 80s. Sid Vicious passed away in 1977, but as I said, I wasn't a big Sex Pistols fan, and I don't know many people who were, at least in the U.S.
Right.
Did you ever see them in concert?
No, never.
Were they ever here in concert? Probably doubtful.
Doubtful, yeah. Probably some of the guys in other groups, but not the Sex Pistols themselves.
Spotlight year, Frankie, 1974. In the past, we kind of poo-pooed that year, didn't we? We didn't think it was that great of a year. It was an off year.
It wasn't the greatest year for some of them, but, you know, even a bad year in rock and roll can have some great things in it.
Clapton, 461 Ocean Boulevard.
Fantastic record.
Now, you probably have seen the HBO documentary, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart, by the Bee Gees. They were asked to spend some time in Miami at 461 Ocean Boulevard, because just a year or two earlier, Eric Clapton was there recording and had such great success. And,
right.
You know, you're surrounded by palm trees, warmth, and of course they took turns recreating that iconic pose of his by the front yard palm tree. So that's what got them together again in that main course album of 1975 with Nights on Broadway and Fanny and got their career going.
Yeah, that really kicked them back into high gear.
So this was just a year earlier, Clapton and 461 Ocean Boulevard. Wings, Band on the Run. I know it came out in 73, but it had the most of its success, the height of its success in 74.
Yeah, it was definitely kind of an album of that summer, really.
That was a good album. Band on the Run, great song. It was Jet was on there, Helen Wheels, Bluebird, good tunes. Stevie Wonder, fulfilling this first finale. And that's his 17th studio album by the age of 24. It was critical of the Nixon administration, who wasn't by
exactly.
then.
Exactly.
And featured a cameo by the Jackson 5.
That's right. And you haven't done nothing yet.
Haven't done nothing.
Yeah.
Boogie on Reggae Woman. One of my favorite albums, but it certainly was great for Stevie at the time.
And it won another Grammy for him. Three in a row he won there.
He won three Grammys, Album of the Year, beating out Band on the Run, Back Home Again by John Denver, who we've mentioned time and again, Elton John's Caribou, and Court and Spark by Joni Mitchell.
Records.
Yeah, good stuff. What'd you think about Genesis, Lamb Lies Down?
Love that one. One of their last with Peter Gabriel as part of the group, and I love that record.
Carpet Crawlers was on that one. Staple of classic rock stations, who still like to play that kind of music. Bowie, Diamond Dogs, the 8th album produced in studio by David. He's our featured artist in our next episode. Number one in the UK, number 5 here. What'd you think of Diamond Dogs?
It was a good record. It was kind of a holding pattern between Aladdin Sane and what would become Young Americans, but it was a good record.
He disbanded his band Spiders from Mars. He was hesitant to go on with his Ziggy Stardust persona, so he wasn't quite sure where his career wanted to go after that, but I think it did okay.
Oh, I think so.
Did well. It had Rebel on there, and David got a new producer himself.
That's right.
Sheer Heart Attack by Queen and Queen 2. That was just before we heard from them with Killer Queen and, of course, Night at the Opera. Pretzelogic, we spoke about last year, as Steely Dan was one of our featured artists. That was a good album, wasn't it?
Oh, fantastic.
Bad Company hit the scene, their smash debut, with Paul Rogers out in front. They call them a super group. I'm not sure I would put them quite in that category, but they did have some good tunes, didn't they?
They definitely did.
Can't Get Enough, Rock Steady. That's all from the first album.
Right.
And Seagull's a great song. I love that one. Jackson Browne, Late for the Sky. What'd you think about that?
Early Jackson Browne, excellent stuff.
David Geffen was running Asylum Records at the time and made sure that that song, that album was recorded quicker and for a lot less money than the one before. He wasn't overly pleased with For Every Man, but there was some good stuff on there. Relayer by Yes. Rick Wakeman had just left the band earlier in the year after a disagreement over the band's direction. When have you heard that before?
Never.
Both did well in the States and in the UK, recorded in Chris Squire's garage studio. It's the first time the group had recorded in a studio outside of London, and they were Hall of Fame inductees in 2017. They're a good band.
Fantastic.
Breakout Artists, 1974. Get this list of artists, and some in the Rock Hall. Billy Joel. What'd you think?
Fantastic. And that was as early as it got.
Yeah, Piano Man.
That right back to Piano Man.
Kiss, yes. Inducted in 2014. They were also a breakout band, or perhaps not a band you first heard, but they either were signed or were starting to get their records put out to the public, so people started hearing about them.
Right.
Hall & Oates, also inductees from 2014. They were the first group to be inducted from Philadelphia, but the first album of theirs didn't do so well. Second one, Abandoned Luncheonette, featured She's Gone.
She's Gone. It's a terrific cut.
One of your favorite bands is ABBA, the group from Sweden. ABBA. I guess they're called ABBA now.
Oh, okay.
You know, inducted in 2010. Still wondering why.
Exactly.
But with Waterloo, they were off to a good start.
Yeah, and they definitely had a few hits here in the States.
They had some catchy tunes. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe they might have been better off in the 60s with some of that bubblegum sound, but Dancing Queen was good, Knowing Me, Knowing You, and but SOS, and I Do, and that's not my cup of tea.
Got old very quick for me.
Speaking of Hypnosis, who just purchased a bunch of music catalogs, Barry Manilow was in that group.
Oh, really?
And he just got his start in 1974, putting out that album, and then Barry Manilow 2, which featured, you know, Mandy and It's a Miracle. One was that Could It Be Magic?
Mm-hmm.
And he was founded by Clive Davis. Just before that, worked with Bette Midler in New York and did those jingles, which you still hear these days, like State Farm and Stridex. Well, you don't hear about Stridex anymore,
I guess.
But McDonald's, KFC.
McDonald's, definitely.
He sang some of those and wrote all of those. Dolly Parton was a breakout artist as well.
I didn't realize that.
Isn't that cool? Chaka Khan. Now, she's an interesting artist. Apparently, she's working on some tracks in a recording studio, and Stevie Wonder was right next door. So he liked her sound and said, I'm going to write you a hit song.
Oh, boy.
So he played it for her, and guess what? She didn't like it.
Yeah.
Imagine telling Stevie Wonder before anybody knows who you are.
Exactly.
I don't like it. So he said, that's all right. I'll go write you another one. And he did. Tell Me Something Good was the next one he wrote.
Oh, really?
Number one.
Okay.
Talk about Patient Man.
Terrific stuff.
Atlanta Rhythm Section, Imaginary Lover, Do It or Die, Spooky. Their first hit, So Into You, in 1977.
That's right.
Oh, they're pretty good. I like
them. Absolutely.
And Bad Company, we talked about, Commodores, and BTO, all 1974. It's the first time we heard from BTO with Let It Ride and then Taking Care of Business.
Right, they'd come out of the Guess Who factory and another Canadian group.
Well, they tailed off fast, though, didn't they?
They did.
Members of the funk and soul band known as the Commodores met while attending Tuskegee Institute, now university.
Mm-hmm.
They'd not been inducted in the Rock Hall, which is interesting. But they were inducted into the Alabama Music Hall of Fame and the Vocal Group Hall of Fame. They opened for Jackson 5 in the early 70s before signing with Motown. Of course, led by Lionel Richie. Commodores would have a couple of hits on their own after Lionel Richie took off into the 80s as a solo artist. Top Songs 1974. We've spoken about some of these before. The Joker, Let It Ride, John Denver's Annie Song, and Sunshine on My Shoulders both went to number one. He was as big as any artist in 74, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Longfellow Serenade, Neil Diamond, coming off that Hot August Night album, that live album.
Mm-hmm.
Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me in 1974, also a big hit for Elton John, and Benny and the Jets.
Right, off the Yellow Brick Road album.
Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo, Rick Derringer. Whatever Gets You Through the Night, John Lennon, with a little help from his friends. The Entertainer, Marvin Hamlisch. Please Come to Boston by Dave Loggins, who I think he's related, isn't he, to Kenny Loggins somehow?
Somehow, I believe.
I Honestly Love You, Olivia Newton-John, was really doing well that year. Rock the Boat, Rock Your Baby, Rock Me Gently, you know, Call on
the
Me.
The Rocks.
Yeah, the Rocks. Call on Me by Chicago, The Air That I Breathe, The Hollies, good tunes.
Oh, fantastic.
74. not so good songs. The Streak, Spiders and Snakes, and Clap for the Wolfman. That was kind of a goofy song.
Oh, that's right. I almost forgot that one.
Remember Mockingbird?
Yes,
by
I do.
JT and Carly Simon.
And Carly Simon.
Bobby Vinton, Who Could Forget My Melody of Love?
Mm-hmm.
I wish we could. Aries 2, Touch the Wind by Mocedades.
Aries 2. Oh,
Aries
my God.
2. Kung Fu Fighting, Midnight at the Oasis, Hooked on a Feeling, Billy Don't Be a Hero. Most of those were out even before the summer hit.
Exactly. That's kind of what made 74 not such a great year.
Such a great year. Kung Fu Fighting was out toward the end of the year and went to number one. Maria Muldaur's Midnight at the Oasis, right in the spring of 74. Right when you were graduating high school.
That's right.
Top R&B artists that year, though, TSOP by MFSB, Al Wilson's Show and Tell, Do It Till You're Satisfied by BT Express, Gladys Knight and the Pips, You're the Best Thing, Love Unlimited Orchestra, Love's Theme,
Who
can forget that? 3 Degrees, One While I See You, Cool in the Gang, Hollywood Swingin', Al Green, and Sideshow by Blue Magic, Al Green, Shalala, great tune, Johnny Bristol, Hang On In There, Baby, Billy Preston.
Anything by Billy Preston, I love.
We talked about Rufus and their number one song, and the Stylistics were still hitting it with You Make Me Feel Brand New.
Mm-hmm.
Man, good stuff. I love R&B music. My brother, as I said before, was into R&B and anything Motown and the Philadelphia sound. That was fine by me. Top songwriters, we mentioned Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. They wrote over 170 gold and platinum records. Hall of Famers in the non-performer category in the year 2008, that amazing Philadelphia sound of theirs. They wrote Me and Mrs. Jones and Backstabbers and For the Love of Money, When Will I See You Again. They were just fantastic songwriters. One Hit Wonder Time. I don't think we're going to run out of these, do you think?
No, Mike? Never.
Lou Michaels, Late Summer 71, Do You Know What I Mean? The American rocker is 75 years old. He had that big hit. What did you think? I love that song.
Oh, that's a terrific song. In fact, I didn't even realize it was a one-hit wonder. I thought he'd done other stuff, but when you think back on it, that was pretty much the only one.
It used a Hammond organ as its primary instrument, and that wasn't done very much at the time. Very, very unusual. He released 9 albums over his career. But they didn't do very well. He later signed on with Columbia Records, and things kind of fizzled out for him after that. His follow-up song was not a big hit. It was Marvin Gaye's Can I Get a Witness. It only hit number 39 Christmas
Day. That's right. In 1971. I remember that.
But that was a nice song. It was a good tune to end the summer, I thought. Brownsville Station and Smokin' in the Boys' Room, number 3 in the early part of 74.
A fun song.
Yeah, brought back, 11 years later by Motley Crue. Later on, 74, Kings of the Party made it to number 31 in the nation, but this was by far their biggest song from the Ann Arbor, Michigan-based group.
Yeah, Brownsville Station was always one of those groups you heard about and was always touring, but never really broke the barrier into being becoming a great group.
It was recorded in 1981 after being translated to Hebrew.
Now that's incredible.
Why would anybody do that?
I don't know.
So a brand new feature from time to time. We'll bring it back. It'll be 5 Live. Frank will choose 3 of his favorite live albums, and then I'll throw in a couple of my favorites. First up, no particular order, is Chicago. Chicago 4 at Carnegie Hall. Frankie, what'd you think of that one?
What a terrific album. It kind of was called at the time the garbage can album. And what I'm saying about that is that it kind of had everything in it. It had 4 records. And also with it came a bunch of posters, a program, everything in the world came in with the package. So you could literally lay there for hours and just look at the packing materials as you listen to the album. And it was a terrific album. It really was. It got all the highlights of the first 3 albums and a few unknown that we hadn't heard before from. So it was really good.
And as we know, Chicago was great in concert. And they liked kind of doing their improvisational jazz thing, didn't they?
Especially on songs like Free, where they let Walt Perezatter really kind of showcase his talents and do more than just play kind of within the lines. They did a lot more, like you said, improvisation.
So it's as if you were at the show and picked up some nice swag on the way out, a poster, maybe the CD nowadays. And
absolutely.
Fun. What did the Columbia Records think about that 4-record set? Do you happen to know what they might have thought about that?
I think they they didn't mind it. It did well on the charts, and they were able to charge a lot for it.
Yeah,
so they
that's
always
true.
Like when they can do that.
Did you find it under your Christmas tree, or was it something that was out earlier in the year?
It was out earlier in the year. I had to save up for quite a while to get it because it was, like I said, a little more expensive than the average album was going for at the time.
So you said Chicago 4 at Carnegie Hall, that 4-record set did well. One mm-hmm. of my favorites is one that didn't do so well, Back to the Bars by Todd Rundgren, but it remains one of my favorite live albums. And I did find that under my Christmas tree in the December of 1978. It was recorded here at the Cleveland Agora, the Roxy in L.A., and the Bottom Line in New York City. His record company, Bearsville, wanted him to do some stuff where he was just not doing his experimental with his Utopia, you know, Wizard, a True Star, and stuff like that. They said, can you just play some hits? Go back and play stuff people want to hear. You know, you can get off on tangents and stuff, but people want to hear it wouldn't have made any difference, and Dream Goes On Forever. And one of the songs I really like about that is was recorded at Cleveland Agora, Dream Goes On Forever. It was our class song, 1978, over at Lakewood. But he said in later years, when you call up YouTube clips, he was playing before a music college, and he said it's very difficult to play this, especially in concert, because of the descending fifths, and I don't know about music theory.
Right, exactly.
Even he had a hard time plucking his way through it on stage on the day that he was kind of giving this master class to the students. But he did it perfectly at Cleveland Agora. The one thing I have that is my that one beef about it is it didn't contain Just One Victory. And you would think it would with all those shows that he did.
Oh, absolutely.
He had some help from Rick Derringer. Stevie Nicks was there. Daryl Hall and John Oates would perform from time to time. Most of the sides, 1 and 4, were recorded at the Agora in August of 1978, right about the time that he was one of the bands, or one of the acts that appeared at the World Series of Rock. So he must have spent a little time in Cleveland. And I didn't see him at the Agora, but I did see him at the Cleveland Stadium, at the World Series of Rock, which wasn't a great venue for him. It was way too big. But the Agora was perfect. Secondly, for Frankie, what's your second favorite live album? In no particular order.
Let's go with Raisin' Hell by Elvin Bishop.
Elvin Bishop. Mickey Thomas, lead singer.
Absolutely. Both he and Mickey Thomas and Elvin Bishop went back and forth throughout the album as far as the lead vocals. And one of the fun things about this record is that it's done with the help of Tower of Power horn section, which really made a difference. They were, in fact, the Elvin Bishop show band,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they did. They came on stage, and you can just hear the fun they're having in the background. They're really enjoying themselves, and I think that's why I like it so much, is just that they're having fun with it.
And because when they're having fun, it translates to you having fun in the audience,
absolutely.
Doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And that's your favorite kind of show, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it's my favorite kind of show is when I'm enjoying myself. I don't like to take music too seriously. Yes, there are certain songs I do, but for the most part, I like to have fun. I like to party,
mm-hmm.
and that is a party album.
Paul McCartney and Wings is my second one. Wings Over America, that triple live album set. It was released in December of 76. It featured just 3 Beatles songs we've spoken before that they weren't getting along. They were kind of getting along, the members of the band. John was, of course, still doing his thing, although I think he was on his sabbatical at the time. But you'd still see him once in a while show up with Elton John on stage or something, do some backup work. I've Just Seen a Face, Yesterday, and Lady Madonna, and then Blackbird and Long and Winding Road were the only 5 songs that he did in this whole tour, and has subsequently done more Beatles stuff along
Absolutely,
the way.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
But what I liked about it was an interesting story. He'll say to you, you know, Silly Love Songs was not even released yet, even though it was recorded, and it didn't appear on some of those early sets. But as it picked up speed, and by the time he got to Cleveland in May of 1976 at the Richfield Coliseum, Silly Love Songs was climbing the charts and soon to be number 1 in the nation. So
that's right. It was becoming a big hit.
Yeah. So people really liked that song. More than 600,000 people attended his 31 shows, which spanned more than a year from September 75 through October of 76 at the Coliseum. Did you get a chance to see him by chance?
No, I
there?
Didn't. But what I like about Wings Over America is that it really gives Wings their due as a band. They were quite a good band, not just a fill-in for the Beatles. They were a good band in their own right.
And even Linda was doing some things on the keyboard.
Correct.
What's your third one? This will be our fifth of five.
I think I'll go with the Talking Heads, or Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense.
Yeah.
This was actually a movie that was done by filmmaker Jonathan Demme. And yes, that Jonathan Demme.
From Philadelphia.
Right. And very well known. It's done many excellent movies. And so again, when you look at the fun that a group has, they put on a show, and it started, the show started with pretty much just David Byrne and the Minimal, and by the end they had a full band up there with backup singers and backup musicians. It was a tremendous show, and they played pretty much all their big hits from the early part of their career.
Good stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I can't do much better than live performances of Take Me to the River, and Once in a Lifetime is another one that comes off really well on the album.
So there's no shortage of great live albums during that tremendous period of rock, and we'll bring back our five live feature from time to time. Now to our featured artist of the week, ELO, the Electric Light Orchestra Hall of Famers 2006. Jeff Lynne, Bev Bevan, Roy Wood, Lynne Bevan, and keyboardist Richard Tandy were the only consistent members of the band. Lynne's desire was to create a sound which featured modern rock, pop songs, classical overtones. They achieved their goal.
They certainly did. What a terrific band.
They would sell over 50 million albums in a 13-year period of recording and touring. Did you see ELO in concert by any chance?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Only one time, though, and that was at the stadium, which was not necessarily the best place to see anybody, particularly a band that featured strings.
Yeah.
I don't know that the sound was exactly there.
So Jeff Lynne reformed the band with Richard Tandy as Jeff Lynne's ELO. That was 6-7 years ago.
That's right.
You know, they would still be touring today if they were able to, because of the pandemic, nobody's been doing anything.
Exactly.
The Electric Light Orchestra, their first album released way back in 1971 in the UK, March of 72 here in the US. It was pieced together over the course of almost a year. They had some other stuff. The Chuck Berry rocker, Roll Over Beethoven, came from ELO 2. What'd you think of that one?
What a fantastic record that was. And it was, Roll Over Beethoven was done by, a number of different groups. And that's my favorite of the bunch. But some did better on the charts, such as the Beatles.
Yeah.
And we know Walter Murphy, but I really like that.
T-Rex member Mark Bolan played guitar on that song. And, a couple of the tracks from the album, at least, as well as a couple of other ELO albums before his untimely death in 1977.
I never knew that. That's some good information there.
All the songs on the third day, their next album, were written by Jeff Lynne. They didn't do the cover songs other than the Chuck Berry, but you know, the Stones did some covers, quite a few actually. The Beatles would do some covers
early on in their career.
But Showdown was a good one. Mama, Ma Belle. You know, Mark Bolan played on it again and died in just before his 30th birthday.
Ugh, what a tragic loss that was.
The first concept album about a daydreamer called El Dorado was released in 1974 as their fourth studio album. The El Dorado Overture, Boy Blue, the hit song Can't Get It Out of My Head, hit the charts here, and then ELO was on their way here in the United States, weren't they?
They sure were. Can't Get You Out of My Head is just a terrific song, and I remember my sister going over to Europe that summer. And she said that was the only song she heard all summer.
It featured cellist Hugh McDowell, who started playing the cello at age 4. Hugh won a scholarship to a music school at age 11, started playing with ELO on their tours at age 19. Another cellist named Michael Edwards joined the band in the early years and was killed in a bizarre accident while driving in England in 2010, where a 1,300-pound bale of hay rolled down a hillside and collided with Michael's van. He was killed instantly.
Oh, my God.
Showdown, one of ELO's compilation albums, came out in the late part of 1974. That's when I got that one. I think I got that as a Christmas gift or something. And that's when I first started getting with ELO, because of Can't Get It Out of My Head, but also because of Showdown and Rock, Roll Over Beethoven. And I thought that music was really cool. I like anything with strings and rock and roll. That was my favorite. Then Face the Music, September 75. That was a good one. First time, you know, we really started listening to some new stuff of theirs as well.
Yeah, that's a terrific album.
Fire on High was
just
awesome.
Unbelievable.
Fire on High kicks off the album. What a rockin' instrumental it was. It was actually the B-side for future singles Sweet Talkin' Woman and Livin' Thing, which were on two different albums. And other songs like Evil Woman.
That's right.
Strange Magic, Poker, that was a good tune as well. Didn't do so well in Australia. The album only hit number 85 there. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, because it was, I know it was, did well here.
Yeah, hit number 14 in the States, but only number 38 in the UK. Face the Music. Then came 1977, a new world record, still one of my favorites of all time, platinum album, number 5 in the charts. Do Ya, originally recorded with the earlier band The Move.
That's right.
Livin' Thing, So Fine, Telephone Line, number 7 in the U.S. Great tunes. Great year for music, 1977. One critic wrote that this was the Beatles song that never was. Telephone Line. He said it should have appeared on, on Revolver. Okay, that makes sense. I don't know what you would take off Revolver, though, to add Telephone Line.
Exactly.
Certainly not Tomorrow Never Knows. Jeff Lynne loves that album and cites it as his songwriting all-time high.
Really?
New world record. Then came Out of the Blue, that double album set later on in 1977, October to be exact, the best-selling record in their history. What'd you think of Out of the Blue?
It was quite an album. Another one of the kitchen sink albums that kind of had everything in there. It was definitely a fun cover with the Flying Saucer, which they would go ahead and do in concert.
And nice diversion from disco, which was all the rage in 1977, as were other albums like Hotel California and Rumors. The album alone should have been enough to get them into the Rock Hall. It wouldn't have been great if they get in for one album.
Yeah.
So pre-orders of Out of the Blue allowed it to go multi-platinum before its release. So Axl Rose actually was a big fan, calling Out of the Blue an awesome record.
Definitely.
Turn to Stone, Sweet Talkin' Woman, Mr. Blue Sky. The hits just go on and on, don't they? Then, spring of 79, everybody was doing disco. And disco...
Sorry to say so, were Electric Light Orchestra.
It contained 5 hit songs, including Shine a Little Love, Last Train to London, Don't Bring Me Down, which at the time was one of the highest debuting songs in the top 40. And it came from like 1960... It came from like the 69th position or something.
Okay.
And the next week it debuted at number 12. You think this is a surefire number one. And it only made it to the top 5, but still not too bad for Don't Bring Me Down. And then came Xanadu, 1980.
That's right.
You know, Olivia Newton-John, the album did well, but the film flopped.
Yeah, and the opinion of ELO kind of hit the skids then, too.
That was a problem. Kind of did. I'm Alive, All Over the World, Xanadu, you know, it was produced for $20 million. That's a lot of money back then, and only made $23 million.
Mm-hmm.
So barely broke even. Started slowing down a bit after that. The album called Time, the science fiction themed, was released in July of 81. I stopped following ELO. I was on to other things by then.
Sure.
I think they kind of peaked and then tailed off. Kind of like Styx to me, the band. They had their big stuff, and then by the time 1980 dawned, kind of onto some other things. Hold On Tight and Twilight. The album featured a heavy use of synthesizers and combine the influences of rockabilly and new wave, Phil Spector, and
Right. It was more of, like you said, synthesizers rather than the string section that had made them so popular to begin with.
Then Secret Messages, June 83. The title cut and Rock and Roll is King. That's not too bad. It still did well in England. Hit number 4 there, but only number 36 here. So by the time 1983 had come around, I'm not sure if they were still touring. They probably were. But as we move through the 80s, Jeff Lynne continued his songwriting and his production techniques and began working with other acts like the Traveling Wilburys.
That's right.
Tom Petty, Bob Dylan, George Harrison. Good stuff there. He would co-produce the Beatles' Real Love and Free as a Bird. Remember when they found some John Lennon tracks that were kind of unproduced just sitting around?
Oh, and that's right. I remember
that. He brought those back along with a lot of those outtakes and those two huge Beatle compilation CDs they had in the mid-90s and those two songs that came to promote that album, Real Love and Free as a Bird, so he would co-produce that. He worked with George Harrison, loved working with him, and I mean, who wouldn't? He produced Tom Petty's Into the Great Wide Open and Full Moon Fever, plus some stuff from McCartney Bryan Adams, and others. So,
okay.
Certainly a great producer, great Definitely. Songwriter. And Jeff Lynne's latest studio album came out at the tail end of 2019. It's called From Out of Nowhere. So that is ELO, our featured artist of the week, Jeff Lynne. I'm looking forward to seeing him again in concert. I'm sure you are, too. It'd be nice to just see anybody, wouldn't it?
I can't wait.
We'll see you next time around.
Thanks for having me.
Here's what's coming up in Season 2. Season 2 is sure to be an exciting one here on Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations. Our featured artists will range anywhere from Marvin Gaye to Billy Joel to Bob Dylan, and we'll even cover the Cleveland music rock scene over the last few decades. Sure to be a great episode there. One Hit Wonders, those aren't going to run out anytime soon. Frankie and I also will dive into a brand new feature called 5 and 5, where we run down our top 5 albums, and some will overlap, from each particular year from the late 60s through the early part of the 80s. We'll go into a deeper detail of some of the big albums that were out in each year. We also will have a feature called Solo Success or Not. Some artists that decided to leave their successful band and may have had success and may not have. That'll be an interesting and fun one as well. So join us, won't you? So that's what you can expect in a sure-to-be-exciting Season 2 of Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations. For Frank Host, I'm Tim Friedman. Thanks for listening, thanks for downloading, and making this show so successful. We'll see you next time.